I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Andrew, we've been doing well with guests recently, and it continues today. Another fantastic guest.
I mean, just brilliant, and it's we're going to be doing more of this, don't we? Because the ones that we've done so far, they work, and it's well, being blunt, it's less boring for you and me as well. We're having to look at each other and just talk rubbish to each other all the time. It's great to talk rubbish to somebody else,
and that somebody else this week is Johnny Smith. There he is. Look, hello, Johnny Smith. How are you? Are you well?
Hi, I'm good. I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I was worried that you were going to introduce this like, oh, we've had some really great guests on so far, and.
But now Johnny Smith.
And here's Johnny Smith. By way of contrast.
Johnny, no, not at all. We're delighted to have you here. Obviously, people listening will know exactly who you are. You are the Smith from the Smith and Sniff podcast. You are the front man of the Late Break Show on YouTube. Fantastic YouTube channel. Former Fifth Gear presenter, journalist, a little bit of everything.
I suppose so. Yeah, I am a bit of everything. And I'm one of the old school motoring journalists, as we used to call ourselves.
I know. I remember those.
I don't know.
Do you remember when we used to write about cars?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yes. We were talking about that just before we came on air, because I'm so much older than you two. Yeah. I was talking about when I got into this business, all you needed was a piece of paper and a typewriter.
Mm.
And now here we are in a studio going over a live link to Johnny with our own sound engineer in a booth. I couldn't possibly imagine it.
Well, Johnny, I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, you've always had quite a varied sort of car journalism career because you were involved with Fifth Gear for such a long time. So it's a while since you just wrote about cars. But now you're, like many of us, across everything. Do you enjoy this sort of modern media world? Or do you sort of pine for the days when you had your laptop and a magazine to get out the door every month?
It's a good question. I sort of pendulum between one and the other. I like the multimedia world, and I fell into it by accident, really. I like to say that I had a tactical approach to sort of diversifying, but I didn't. Mm. And the truth is the more visual stuff I did, the more stuff like Fifth Gear and video content, the worse I got at writing.
That's interesting, because you think that doing that would sort of give you, because I write so much, I often think if I just didn't write for a month, when I got back to it, I'd just be better at it because my brain would be clearer and I would just, but do you think it's sort of like muscle memory? Do you think you just kind of lose it after a bit?
Well, I did. Yeah. I have to be honest. And I feel quite ashamed that I did. And I built it up mentally to the point where I would procrastinate writing a feature. And then I'd write a bit, blast a bit out onto a page, and then I'd go, no, it's not right. And I'd be moving it around and shuffling around. And I'd overdo it. And then I realized it was just, I'd stay up all night to write 1,000 words. And I realized there was that point of I can't do this anymore, really. I'm
Wow.
I've gone too far down the other road, the visual road, and thinking about so bullet points and talking to camera.
Do you think it's a one-way street? Do you think you can't do a UE and go back?
I think you can.
I tell you
when I enjoy writing is when someone, if someone was to say to me as soon as this podcast ends, I need you to write a blog about, I don't know, why German electric cars aren't very good. Can you do it in the next hour? I think I'd be okay.
Yeah.
Because I'd just smash it out and it would be right there, bang.
We'd take that story if you've got time after this.
But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, just briefly sort of talking as a journalist, sometimes your best stuff comes when you don't have a choice. I mean, usually what happens, it will be, sorry, this sounds slightly sort of morbid, but someone will die.
Yeah.
And we need to get something, some kind of appreciation of this person's life up there, you know, within an hour of learning about this event. And so you sit down and you think, oh God. And you, as you say, you just smash it out. Mm. And then you come back to it 24 hours later and you think, blimey, I did that in an hour.
Mm.
Yeah.
If I'd actually sat down and thought about it, I probably couldn't have done that well in a day.
Completely.
Yeah.
And it's almost doing a disservice calling it a smashing out, because it's not smashed out. It's actually like its most heartfelt.
Mm.
It's in your gut, isn't it?
Don't overthink it.
So, Johnny, I've already mentioned the Smith & Sniff podcast. Of course, we're sworn enemies, aren't we, really?
Yeah. We hate you.
It's all friendly rivalry.
It is. No, it is. That's why we've got you on the podcast. And hopefully we'll get the wonderful Richard Porter on at some point. But you guys started the podcast at just about the same time we did. So I don't know if you count your episodes, if you label them, but you must be on 200.
We did 200 last week.
Did you?
Oh, my God. We're exactly the same. Almost exactly the same point.
We did 200. So we were doing it in video form prior to pandemic.
Mm, yes.
And losing money because we were paying to have it professionally edited. I used to film it. We'd physically have to take a day or half a day out to meet one another because we don't live anywhere near one another. It was a daft idea, really, but we were enjoying ourselves. I built up a bit of a sort of cult following. And then pandemic meant we had to do it via podcast, and as a few people predicted, it was much more popular in that form and a lot bloody easier. So that's that. And we get the odd person saying, shh, are you going to do any more video? And actually, I'd like to do more video, and that's in an ideal world. Like every quarter, I'd like to do like a proper piece of video work, like driving somewhere for a real purpose. But it needs to pay for itself, really. So
it's not a hobby, is it?
Yeah.
It's not a hobby.
No,
not anymore. No, it's actually classed as a real business.
Yes.
Without wishing to spend too much time sort of publicising the opposition, just tell us how you and Richard, who is the Sniff out of Smith & Sniff, where did the idea come from? Who approached who? What started Smith & Sniff?
We met at a few events and launches, and I think we had our best, like, first chit chat at the Geneva Motor Show in a hotel bar.
And I've had a chit chat with you two in a hotel bar.
Yeah, exactly.
Dangerous.
Yeah. And it's usually when you're deliriously tired, right?
Yes, and you've been on the Negronis for a bit.
That's right. And it's exactly what happened. And we realized that we had a pretty similar personality and we got on well. And one thing led to another, a few emails and texts and stuff. And I said one day, I know you're busy with Top Gear and I'm busy with Fifth Gear and other stuff, but I said one day we should try and do something together. I think there could be like a little side project, whatever that is. And he agreed. And this was for years we said this and never did anything, probably 7 years.
Wow.
And then finally we decided to commission to have some videos made, and we had some stuff professionally shot, we had some stuff professionally edited but shot by me, and we thought, let's just put it out there and see what happens. And that was the beginning of it, really. I think Smith & Sniff was actually our working title. I think we were going to call it something else.
Do you remember what?
Better. I'm trying to remember now.
The name works.
Yeah. Well, it does work in that, I suppose, as long as you know that Richard is not a sniffer.
It works for you.
Yeah,
it works for me fine.
We haven't got time to go back into the history of Sniff Petrol.
No.
But that in itself was such a phenomenon that I think most people understand that Richard Porter is Sniff.
Yeah. So how much of your time is the podcast? Is it sort of an hour a week, or do you, it is an hour a week.
It is about an hour to hour and a half a week. And I record it every single time, unless we're together in person here, right where I'm sat at my dining table, because acoustically, for some reason, it seems to work, even though the dining table is like marble, which is a nightmare, apparently. But whatever we do, we just seem to have, we have the same mic on the same settings, and he phones me and I have my headphones on, and that is, and I send the file to him. He edits it and takes a bit more money than I do. and then I help to, I do the social media, so I'm now going to have some of that money back. So that is really it. And we just, because we're really British about it, we just kind of like, we decided eventually to set up a Patreon thing and ask people to send no more than £1. And that was it. And now we're starting to do live events again as an exploration.
You've done a few now, haven't you?
Done 10. The one last week in Glasgow was our 10th.
Yeah.
So when are you buying the Lamborghini?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. A few people have said stuff like that. Yeah, when are you going to get your first Ferrari? It's like, no, I'm not there. I'm not there, sadly. But
yet.
It'll come. We might do a real tour, like where we put all the dates out at the beginning of a year and do the year. We haven't got that yet.
Yeah, we were discussing, I want the T-shirt. You need to do a 1980s metal T-shirt with all the dates on the back.
Down the back, in the list.
We have to do that. Optional sleeveless T-shirt as well, if you want to go full 80s.
That's not a good look, chat.
It's not a good look.
Smith and Sniff podcast. I mean, we shouldn't promote the opposition
absolutely
too much,
not.
Should we?
But terrible. It's terrible. Don't listen to it.
It is a very funny podcast. So sometimes they talk about cars.
We do sometimes.
But if you want Johnny Smith on cars, the Late Break Show, YouTube, you've got more than 600,000 YouTube subs nowadays. You're producing a lot of stuff. And it's fantastic YouTube content, and we'll talk about that a bit more. Do you like this epithet, the Louis Theroux of cars?
I do actually. I'm really really pleased that I've been compared slightly to Louis, because Louis actually has always been my hero in terms of his approach to interviews, and that way he's very disarming, but yet gets the best out of the people.
Yeah.
And so for years I used to watch his stuff and think, he's brilliant. How does he do that? I mean, he's got even more famous now, but that was always my aim. That was always my aspiration of, like, I want to be the Louis Theroux of cars. I want to delve into the car culture a bit more with that tone, if I can, and see what happens.
And to just sort of, I mean, what is so great about him is that he doesn't think he's the story. He lets his subjects do the talking, and he just primes them and lets them go. And that's always the way that I think you get the best out of people. And sometimes you get interviewers who are, you know, really using it as a vehicle for them. And you don't do that. You just kind of celebrate what's in front of you, whether it's necessarily something that you're particularly into. The very fact that whoever it is you're talking to is enough.
Yeah,
it's very charming.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's really kind, because, I mean, I never thought it would. I had a hunch that there'd be enough interest for people to understand that it's not just the cars a lot of the time. When you're talking about sentiment, it's the people behind the cars and the reasons for having what they have. And you realise it gets quite emotional.
Yeah,
when you're dealing with barn finds and stuff,
I want to talk to you about barn finds.
Stuff that's been squirreled away. It gets really emotional. Sometimes it takes me over a year, sometimes 2 years actually, to convince the people to let me come and see the car, meet them. And people don't realise that often. Like, you can't just make one call and then just turn up. It's not like that. You know, there's a reason why a car gets locked away for 40 years, and we don't always understand it.
Okay, so talk us through the best barn find. Is there one which is really, I'm not talking about the most valuable or anything, but just the one which you have just thought, wow, I'm so pleased we managed to do this.
There's been a few, hasn't there? I know it's an exotic, but I've done two Lamborghini Espada barn finds now, which is bonkers. One was in a real barn in Cumbria, the most scenic, perfect textbook barn find ever, with a really mysterious backstory that's still not entirely resolved, but the car is back on the road now, I'm glad to say. So that was so special because I thought I'm never going to get a chance to do a true Lamborghini barn find again.
Yeah.
The other Lamborghini barn find was at the Ashby Manor, where the gunpowder plot was plotted.
Wow.
And it was actually in the building underneath where the plot room was. It's called the plot room now.
Blimey.
With Guy Fawkes, which was like, how cool is that? And again, it was another Espada. It's like, what's going on with Espadas? They all seem to be broken and pushed away and locked up. But the one that one of the ones that was really emotional and beautiful as well was in Wales, and it was a widow who had the 911, a 1977 or 78 911 SC, in this beautiful petrol blue. And she was so upset. She was so in love with her husband that she'd lost, and she knew that this Porsche that had been handed down to him from his dad was like a member of the family. And she'd already lost him, of course, and she'd resigned herself to the fact she was going to sell the car because she wanted to give her nephew enough money to get on the housing ladder. And this was the only realistic way of doing it. And all day when we were filming with her, besides the fact she was just so full of joy and just really a funny lady, and she'd had this strange story where she had a lovely Escort RS2000 that got stolen, and it got found being used by a pimp.
Wow.
The most random story. Yeah, brilliant. That car still exists. I tracked it down. It's actually a rally car in Wales. So she thought it was
scratched. So this is a sort of a late 70s RS2000.
Yeah, that's right.
A professional's RS2000.
A professional's, exactly. So it's a yellow one of those with a black vinyl.
Wow. Room. Okay, cool.
And she said that car is the reason why I ended up moving out of Coventry or Birmingham, wherever she lived, to Wales in the middle of nowhere. And then she, I went into her house, and her late husband's bookshelf was there next to the sort of like the downstairs toilet. And it was just all these books about Porsche and racing and engines. And it was, you could tell that she was going to find this day difficult, and she desperately wanted me to get the car running, and I didn't get it running in the end, which frustrates the hell out of me. It's quite hard. It's quite difficult to get cars running sometimes, and I'm not a mechanic professionally at all. So you know, I kind of do what I think I can do, and then I leave it. So that was, and that car was beautiful. So I drove away from that happy, but also frustrated because I knew I wouldn't be able to afford to buy it. And then there was a Ford Granada. There was a Mark II Ford Granada. I've always had a bit of an affinity to Granadas anyway. I've had a couple, and my dad had a Mark II Estate, which this one was. But this was a
hang on. So a Mark II Granada, is that like a Cowley Granada, as in a George Cowley Granada, as in Back to the Professionals?
Yes, or, I think it was. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So the latter,
so not the one that goes through the window at the beginning of the Professionals. So that was actually a console, wasn't it? But that was, I think, from the Mark One Granada era.
That's the later one.
So the late '70s, early '80s.
Late '70s, early '80s.
Sorry, that's right. Okay, fine, cool.
So the boxier one, and
exactly.
That I'm still sadly the Banger Race's favourite, and but this one had been parked up for about 30 years. But the reason why I went to film it is because I've been tipped off about it by a chap that watched the channel, who's a surgeon, I think, in a hospital. And one of his colleagues is a nurse, and it's her dad's car. He passed away. Her mum is very old now and quite frail, and this car's been in the garage all this time. But it was a Chasseur edition, and a Chasseur edition I had never heard of. It turns out it had loads
of dramatic laughter.
Honestly, it was so 70s. It was like the run out, really, of the Mark II. So it was the 2.8 V6.
I can't remember what you got extra with the Chasseur.
You got your own luggage set that was color coded to the car. And the car
did it still have it?
Yes, it did. Which
it still has the luggage.
It had all of its table luggage, which fits in the side pods of the car.
Yeah.
And it was this lovely kind of weird tartan slash houndstooth material with brown inserts in the seats. I mean, the interior was one off for that model. And it had all of the extras thrown at it. It had gold alloy wheels. That's what you ordered it with. It came with gold alloys. It was brown.
Just so everybody knew that you had truly arrived.
It was brown and bronze two-tone with brown and tartan interior.
Oh, I'm going to need to go and look this up.
Honestly, it's a rare car, a seriously rare car. And I think they sold more in Germany than they did over here. And in Germany, they called it the Sportsman. I think it was called the Sportsman. Well, and it has a really natty little
sportsman
logo.
You couldn't do that now, could you? It would be a sports person.
A person, it would.
It'd be a sports person.
The Ford sports person.
Can we just talk briefly about barn finds generally? Because it's a fascinating thing, isn't it? This relatively recent phenomenon. So this country, and presumably many countries around the world, are just full of cars that have been stuffed into barns and garages and workshops and lockups. And just waiting to be unearthed. It's just amazing, isn't it? Mm. How many are out there? Are we going to run out in the next couple of years? Could it last 100 years?
I think it won't run out in the next few years.
I mean, there are so many of these cars, but actually, because, you know, I've always maintained that cars that were shit when they were new are shit even now. And the secret, and I think, Johnny, what you do is it's just identify, and it doesn't have to be Lamborghinis,
something
just seeing that Granada and understanding the particular context of that exact model and the story behind it. Because I mean, I'm sure that there are all sorts of, you know, rubbish lying behind doors, which nobody would be interested in or want to try and save. And that's the skill, isn't it? But I agree with you. I don't think that you're going to run out anytime soon. There are just so many of these things, which just got squirreled away.
It is bizarre. I mean, especially in a small country like the UK, it is alarming how many things have been just put away and locked up. But I think sometimes there's two things that I love about barn finds. One of them is it appeals to my childlike curiosity. And ever since I was a kid, we used to love exploring and we used to love cycling out into the middle of nowhere and sniffing around farmyards and sometimes finding a car in a hedge or an abandoned car at the end of a lane. And it's still just as fun for me, just like I was when I was a kid. And two, it's not always the pedigree of the car. It's the condition of the car. So I've found cars that aren't really desirable. They're rare, but nobody cares, as I call them. But they're immaculate, like the time capsule immaculate. Mm. And just that's the part of it that fascinates me. I go, this is a car that was average at best when it was new. But somebody's locked it away and kept it for 30 years, and it's done 12,000 miles. And honestly, with a clean and some new brake pipes, you could probably use it every day for the next 20 years. It's just weird.
You must have been to the Festival of the Unexceptional.
I actually haven't, which is alarming, given
it's very
10 miles from my house.
Honestly, John, you go there, and it's exactly what you're talking about. It is immaculately preserved, base spec Morris Marina Estates. it's all like that, and you know, and Renault 9s that have done 400 miles and you just walk around and you go there thinking one thing and you come away thinking something completely different. So you go there thinking, oh, this is going to be a laugh, and you come away actually quite touched. And again, it's not so, I mean, the cars are amazing, but actually the story is you talk to the people and you hear their absolutely genuine passion for these things.
Yeah.
And it's like all things where, you know, there's an infectious enthusiasm that you cannot help but rub off on you. And at the end of it, you just think, well, isn't it fantastic that these people exist? Because these cars, which are now, some of them are, you know, rarer than Ferrari GTOs because they've all just rusted. Yeah. They've all just gone. And then suddenly you'll see something like, you'll see, I don't know, an Alfa Romeo Arna or a Triumph Acclaim or something like that. And I haven't seen one of these things for 40 years. And I go to the Goodwood Festival of Speed and I see, you know, endless GTOs and that sort of thing. And it's actually, you go back and you see these things and it's just, it's a really weird kind of wonderful, but no less wonderful for that.
Completely. And I think that there's it's like a comfort blanket, those sorts of cars. There's a weird little nostalgic warmth to them. And I love that people love them.
They're relatable, aren't they? People can relate to these cars that they maybe grew up in the back seat of.
We grew up in the back of them.
Absolutely. And we are fortunate enough to drive a lot of cars which we probably could never afford. Yeah, and absolutely. We know people that afford incredibly rare, beautiful cars. But I think there's nothing wrong with appreciating all the real lo-fi, odd working class stuff as well. I almost feel like that's what my part of my channel and my own fascination is about. If I could find an Immaculate Matra Rancho in right hand drive.
Festival of the Unexceptional. It might be a bit too nice for the Festival of the Unexceptional. I would watch a Johnny Smith video reporting for the Festival of the Unexceptional. I would, yeah.
I am lots going this year. I'm good. Officially going this year. This is the first time.
Are you judging?
I will have, I don't know if you I'm judging. Official...
I've judged it for a couple of years and it's one you of the best things. You... Yeah, I have. And it's just one of the best things you can do. Because you know they're, all the judges, you know quite a bit. I mean, most of them, frankly, know a lot more than me about all this stuff. But you go around, and it's just completely subjective. But that's when you get to talk to the people, because you know they're all standing there proudly by their cars, and you know, and the cars want them. But you go up to them, and you go, tell us about this car. Why do you have it? What have you done with it? And they're all, and it's just it's wonderful. Sorry, we're gonna, just talking about
But like we say, I think the older I get, the more I realize it's about the people behind the cars.
Completely. Absolutely.
Also more than the cars.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So it's, I mean, just listening to that conversation alone, people will understand that Johnny's YouTube output is different to a typical YouTube channel about cars.
Yeah.
Because you're interested in, well, A, slightly more obscure stuff, but B, and perhaps more importantly, the people and the stories behind cars. So it's it's meaningful. But you, what's interesting to me, Johnny, is that you seem to break all the YouTube rules, but get away with it. So you produced a video on a twin engine Citroen 2CV, which I would suspect has not got massive YouTube potential. And that video has flown through 300,000 views in no time at all.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it?
It must be gratifying.
It is gratifying. And it's often a bit of a gamble because, like you say, YouTube tries to categorize you.
Yeah.
And obviously the algorithm tries to learn you. And right at the start of creating my own channel, we wanted to make sure that we had all the variety that is in my head, all the stuff that I appreciate. And the problem with that is it's various different pigeonholes. And
yeah,
you can't put it down to like one easy sentence, or they can't go, oh, he's Dan Prosser. He only drives rare 90s sports cars. Oh, he's Andrew Frankel. He only drives historic stuff pre-war. And that's easy for an algorithm because it goes, oh, they do that, they do that. Whereas I go, well, one minute I'm dragging an old thing out of a barn. The next minute I'm driving a futuristic electric car. The next minute I'm going to a person's private collection where they've got 100 cars in a beautiful old museum. And I'm all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
That scattergun probably irritates YouTube, but we try.
Nevertheless, it seems to have forgiven you for it.
Well, we're trying. We're trying.
You're more than trying. You're doing really well. How long has it been? How long has Late Break been going for?
February 2020. I started it 6 weeks before a thing called a pandemic came along.
Yeah, good timing,
so
Johnny.
That Christmas I decided to go it alone, and it was that Christmas that I sat down and went, I'm going to put all my energy into my own brand. I've worked for a lot of other people and I'm thankful for that. And I've got a reasonable amount of contacts, but no, I'm going to do it myself.
It's exactly, frankly, why we're doing this now. You know, I spent most of my career helping other people build their brands. And I wouldn't be in a position to start something on our own without having done that. But the time just come, doesn't it? Where, you know, you just want to do something for yourself.
Completely. And I'm glad you guys have, because it's great.
Mm.
Oh, thank you very much.
You've built a really authentic, good, strong following, I think, and people, you're a known name now. I hear people mentioning the Intercooler and saying what's on it, and obviously I follow it on Instagram and stuff like that, so I know. And yeah. I know you guys have obviously you've been around a long time. You've got that experience, and I think in a world where a lot of social media and content creators in the car world, they don't necessarily have any experience. They just might shout loudly. Yeah, my worry has always been that real authority might dissolve and disappear.
Well, we'll try and maintain it here for as long as we can. Joey, talk to me about, I mean, you are someone I think perceived probably rightly as, I don't know how you describe, would you describe yourself as an EV evangelist? EV?
Well, certainly an EV enthusiast. And
EV enthusiast. And yet, you also have a 68 charger.
Yes, I do. Yes.
I just think that's completely brilliant. I love
it
that.
It sums it up, doesn't it?
You have a 96, which if anybody knows Dodge Chargers, of all the years that they produced Dodge Chargers, 68 was the year. That is the charger.
It was for me. Yeah.
It was they were the prettiest. Yeah. The 69 and the 70 look similar, but they're just not quite as good.
No, I agree. The front end's not quite as sinister.
No, and it's just a bit more... There's just a bit more sort of stuff on it, isn't it?
It's a bloody damn good-looking car, I've got to say.
It's a cracking car.
Even if it didn't work, I would still appreciate just looking around it. It's one of those, I just think, for a mass-produced car as well. There's so many different angles where it looks good. And I'm so... Because it was always a dream car of mine. I'm so glad that I've finally got to own one. I've had that car now since 2008. Yeah.
And what engines has it got in it?
That's a 383 cubic inch.
A 383.
6.3.
Yeah.
Four-speed manual from the factory. So it's quite a...
That's quite rare, isn't it?
Quite rare, yeah. It's a very oddly optioned car in that it doesn't really have any options, which is one of the reasons why I quite liked it. So somebody ordered it in San Francisco with the smallest big block, so the 383, with the four-speed manual, with no servo and the smallest drum brakes possible and no power steering.
So oh, my God. All of which it still has.
Yeah. All of which it still has. I won't get rid of them. People say, you want to put discs on it. I'm like, no, I want to drive it like it was and really pay attention.
Yes. And among those on the know, we're not going to dwell on this. It's just, I'm only asking because, frankly, I want to know. Is the 383, because you kind of think, most people think about those and they think about 440s, don't they? Yeah. Is the 383 among the Cognoscenti because it's the smallest of the big? Is that known as the sort of the sweetest of them, if not necessarily the most powerful?
They certainly rev freer. And it all really comes down to how you tune them, because you can get an awful lot of power out of a 383 if you want to. I think the 426 Hemi is the one that gets all the headlines because it was the Hemi.
Yeah, but the Hemi is another story, isn't it? Because it was very, very low numbers and they're built for drag strips and that sort of thing.
They weren't a nice street car.
Yeah, exactly. So the 440 is the kind of... That's
440
the sort of...
is probably the best. A well-set-up 440 is hard to beat. It's faster than a Hemi when it's well-set-up and it's more durable than a Hemi. That's why I like Jensen Interceptors, because I mean, a Jensen Interceptor with a 440 and it can fly if it's set up right.
Have you dug one of those out of a barn?
I've found one in a derelict scrapyard, but I haven't I haven't found one yet. I'm sort of glad because I'd be tempted to buy it.
Yes. So the engine in yours, that's the engine that was used as standard in the Interceptor, isn't it? The 383.
That's right. The early ones were 383s, and then the later ones were 440. So all cries.
I think we need to get off this subject because I can spend a day doing this, but we have other stuff to talk about.
So I'm interested. So you are known to be an EV enthusiast. Where does that come from? I mean, can you remember a sort of formative experience, or is it a sort of global point of view that you have around environment and emissions?
I think it was over 20 years ago. It was around about the year 2002, something like that. And I remember seeing on the internet a chap in America, in Oregon, who'd converted a Datsun to electric power himself and was goading sports cars and things on the drag strip.
So this was like a 240Z or something like that?
No, it was worse. It was like a four-door, what was it? It might have been a 240K or a
don't know. Move on. Doesn't matter.
Violet, like a Datsun Violet looking thing.
Right.
And it's called the White Zombie. Anyway, he became quite notorious, and he was a real early adopter of kind of EV muscle, as I started calling it.
Yeah.
And a few years later, I remember being taken out to Japan on a trip with Nissan. And I drove, and I expect you did, Andrew, as well, probably, drove the what became the Leaf, which was the drivetrain of the Leaf, in a Nissan Cube body.
Yeah. I didn't do it in Japan, but they brought one over. I did it here in the UK, yeah.
So I remember driving that around Yokohama and then going on a tour of some other facilities, and they were explaining about the possibility of it, of contactless charging, inverter charging. And I remember driving this thing, this test mule, going, it's so relaxing. And like when you come off the throttle, you don't have to touch the brake because it's sort of like harvesting its power back. And I'm like, this could be great, because when you come to a stop in city congestion, it's not using any power, but yet it feels really serene and enjoyable being in your own little car with nothing running unnecessarily. And I suppose it something inside my head went, there's definitely room for this.
Yeah.
And then I started researching more and more about EVs and why they weren't mainstream these days, and saw this weird, the mystery behind people that had sort of had businesses bought up and squashed, and the invention of the starter motor, which pretty much single-handedly killed the early adoption of EVs. And then I decided I'm going to build an EV hot rod at some point.
Yeah.
And so in 2012, that's what I did. I started building what became the world's quickest street legal EV, which was, I wanted to use a car that was a proper underdog and get people talking.
But just tell us a bit about, I know a bit about it, but just for anybody listening to this who doesn't know what you're talking about, talk us through it.
Well, I wanted to find a car that was an electric car from new. I could. And I found an Enfield 8000 ECC, electric city car, as it's called. Car built on the Isle of Wight, 120 made, very odd.
Yeah.
But actually quite laughable initially, but when you delve into the engineering of it and the background story of it, it was quite fascinating. It was bankrolled by a billionaire shipping magnate, a Greek shipping magnate, using the Enfield automotive name, the motorcycle Enfield name. And it was the head engineer of the project was the chap called John Aykroyd, who went on to be aerodynamics guy behind Thrust 2.
Absolutely.
And he designed the pod, the safety pod for Richard Branson's Round the World Hot Air Balloon Challenge.
Wow.
A really interesting out there guy. So I realized that the aero of this car was amazing, and it was hand-beaten aluminium over a super leggera box section chassis. And it sounds like, hang on a minute, this could be good. So fast forward, I found a flood damaged one, and I spent 3 years converting it into a dragster, but road legal. Had to buy the right batteries, which was the hardest bit, and the right management system. Had to work through a company who had a military account to get the right cells. The cells were from a Bell Super Cobra helicopter.
Wow.
They start the twin jets and they run miniguns. Wow. They were designed to be able to run a minigun at full power, I think, for 20 minutes, which apparently is an incredible amount of power required. But of course, they're light because, helicopter.
Yeah.
So I managed to build this with a lot of help, this car, this street legal drag car, and set some records. And it was a hell of a ride, and I miss it. I miss it dearly. I campaigned it for two seasons and then had to retire it on financial grounds. And
what happened to it? Did you sell it?
I sold it to my main sponsor, who was the nephew of the Greek shipping guy I talked to you about, who set the company up originally in the 60s.
Oh, and he's
a Greek shipping guy. He still has it, but it's in a museum in the UK.
It exists. It hasn't ended up on a scrapper anyway.
And how
fast was it? Do you sort of quarter miles in it and that sort of thing?
We did quarter miles, yeah. So the car obviously had to be MOT'd. It had to run on street tyres, not slicks. And we did the world record was 9.86 seconds at 137. So 0 to 137 in 9.8 seconds. And the European record was, I think, a 10.25 quarter mile at 125. But basically, it was quicker than a Veyron at the time, which was the the car that everybody was talking about. It was quicker over the quarter by at least a second, 1.2 seconds. With a
this was two-wheel drive or four-wheel drive?
Two-wheel drive, yeah.
No, two-wheel drive. So with no traction either?
No traction. We had no launch control, no traction control. It was all in the foot.
Blimey.
Good God.
Yeah. Okay. It was an amazing car.
I do not know. Where do you begin with a project like that, Johnny? That's what I don't understand about that car. If I decided I wanted to go and do this thing, I'd look around, even today, when the technology's come such a long way, and I think, well, I don't know where to start. I won't bother. But you went through and did it. That's amazing.
Well, I'm not an engineer. I come from a family of engineers, but all I know is, as a journalist, you know, you ask the right questions and you find the right people, and that's what I did. I thought, if I've got to have any chance of this being a success and not being laughed out of town, I need to have the right engineer to start building it. So I had the base of it was to take the car straight from where I bought it from, where it was flood damaged, from the lady in Bristol, to Webster Race Engineering near Santapod, who builds drag cars. And I've known him a while, and I said, listen, I've got this idea. This is the wheelbase. It's comically short, and I want it to be able to do 10-second quarter miles and have an MOT. And he just walked around it for 15 minutes with a pencil. I remember he had a pencil in his ear and a little notepad, and he said nothing for 15 minutes. And then he went, yeah, this could be done. And Brilliant. And I've seen what he's built in the past, and I said, well, all of my hopes are resting on you, John. Yeah. So if you think it's possible.
Did you drive it on the road?
Yes, I did. I did the school run in it. I used to drive it into town.
I did.
I mean, Jess Cross came and drove it from Autocar, and it was a real car, but obviously, like all road legal race cars, it was compromised. It had a cage in it. It was, I don't know, really aggressive limited slip diff in it. And yeah, if you look up, there are videos of it, and there is a website that still exists. I think flux-capacitor.co.uk, that was its name, Johnny's Flux Capacitor. It's over 1,000 horsepower in a wheelbase that was 12 inches shorter than an Austin Mini. So
wow,
it could have been a really dangerous car. Everybody told me not to do it. Everyone said it'll wheelie, it'll be out of control, it will kill you. But because of John Webster saying, I think this is going to be okay. I trusted him. Wow. And I had a couple of people on board early on. And I, after all that time, I managed to just break even racing it for 2 years, building it for three, racing it for two.
Wow.
Oh, but what an experience.
Yeah, I'm really pleased. I mean, it was a lot of energy.
Yeah.
It was a lot of energy.
But I bet you don't regret a minute of it.
I don't regret a minute of it. I look back and I speak to my friend who was instrumental in getting it to the track with me and being my kind of like race manager, as it were. And I said to him, I said, those were such good times, weren't they? But yeah, they were awesome. We didn't get much sleep.
That's fantastic. And tell us about the drag racing scene. I mean, it's not sort of glossy motorsport, is it?
No. I think, well, this would be interesting for a lot of your intercooler viewers, listeners, is I think drag racing gets dismissed quickly by us. The same as, I guess, things like NASCAR.
Yeah.
But the thing about drag racing is, like all motorsport, when you're dialed into it competitively, there is such a science behind it, which you didn't realize. Mm-hmm. And to get all of that power and that weight distribution with no tire slip to look clean and smooth and straight is insane.
We did a story, in fact, Colin Goodwin did a story for us about this extraordinary woman, Ida Zetterstrom, who is certainly Europe's fastest drag racer.
Yes.
And we got her to talk us through a run because, I mean, in my sort of rather patronizing naive way, I just thought you just sort of let it go and then pull the parachute. Because certain extraordinary people who do that sort of thing, they kind of have this ability to slow time. And so she just talks you through everything she's thinking about, everything that she's doing. She's busy.
Yeah.
You know, and despite the fact that these things are doing 0 to 100 miles an hour in about 0.8 of a second.
Yeah.
And it's not a quarter mile anymore, is it? It's 1,000 feet, isn't it?
Because that's right.
Is it?
So it's 300 miles in 1,000 feet.
Yeah. So she's still over 300 miles an hour.
Unbelievable.
1,000 feet. And it's absolutely fascinating. If anybody listening to this has never been to Santapod watched Top Fuel Dragster Race, just go. You may only go once, but it is a form of motorsport, unlike anything else you've ever seen. And for drama and theatre and occasion, it's as good as anything. Anyway.
And going back to the human element, it's worth going just to try and work out what is going on in these people's heads, why they devote so much, and go to the pits and watch them rebuild, in the case of Top Fuel, rebuild the engine every run.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a way of life.
Because you have engines which are lifed at less than a minute, which I've always thought was just...
It is absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. But my kids really like it because they've come since they were tiny when I started racing, and they quite enjoy it.
So it is a family sport, isn't it?
Yes.
And so get these young kids who are driving literal rocket ships.
Yeah, and you get these dynasties, don't you? Yeah. There's this lady in America, what's she called? Brittany Force, I think.
John Force's daughter.
Yeah, exactly. But I think she is the fastest drag racer in the world. But she's, you know, she's another one of these sort of ladies who's come through this family process. And it is great. It is a real family, fun, engaging alternative, different way of doing it.
It's also, we talk a lot about needing more women in motorsport. It's one of the motorsports that's had women dominating it for a long time.
I mean, when I first started, had enough column inches said about that. Yeah. No, when I first started going to Santa Pod, probably 30 years ago, even then, I wouldn't say it was dominated by women, but there were a lot. I mean, there were as many as men, and they were doing absolutely as well as men. And
fantastic! What a sport!
Yeah,
yeah, it's great sport. I love it.
So just come back to YouTube, because it probably dominates your working life, doesn't it? Do you feel you've got it sussed? Have you cracked the YouTube thing, or are you still learning?
I'm still learning, Dan. Yeah. It's a beast, as YouTube. It's it's like I feel it's like the surface of the sea. You're on a boat on the sea, and it's constantly changing, going up and down, and there's weather fronts coming in, and there's some stuff you know, and there's some stuff you don't know, and it often feels like I can't entirely control it.
Yeah. So some stuff you thought you knew, but it turns out you didn't, or some stuff you absolutely knew, and then they changed it, so you know nothing anymore.
It's exactly like that.
Yes.
And it's hard when you're obviously investing your own time and money into creating content that you think will be well received, and you think will get shared, and it sometimes doesn't. And I suppose because the thing is, if I knew the formula inside and out, it would be like a musician knowing how to make a hit album or a hit single, hit after hit after hit. It's not that easy. But you can fall out of love with it as a result, because it's...
I was going to say, do you get cross with it sometimes? Do you feel that you've had enough of it sometimes?
I've got that far from having enough, at least twice in 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gosh, and that's with what looks like a really successful channel.
Yeah, and it does. And I suppose you put an enormous amount of hours into it, like any business. It's no different to any self-employed person, I don't think.
Mm. Yeah.
You've got to put in all the hours.
But the difference is, you know, in working life, you know, things can go wrong because you mess up. But things can go wrong in the YouTube world, not because of anything that you've done. And you put your time and your talent and your experience and your knowledge, and you come up with things which you know.
Yeah.
And then something happens. There's some line of code changes in this weird, awful thing everybody refers to as the algorithm. Mm. And then suddenly it doesn't work anymore. And you haven't done anything wrong. But nevertheless, it's your life and your livelihood that's on the line.
Yeah.
And you must just at times feel like a passenger.
Yeah, I do. And when the going's good, you get a real rush off it and you think, this is great. But you know you can't rest on your laurels. You can't just sit back and reap the rewards for too long, which is frustrating, really. But I just have to keep going back to like what the Late Break Show is and what all of those arms of the Late Break Show are, the Barn Find. And the Barn Finds are, going back to those, they are the most popular thing I do. They are the consistent thing, consistent hit. But having that contrast between new cars, old cars, collections of cars, pulling them out of hedges, my own projects, tinkering on those and trying to progress them, And really trying to make people realize that there shouldn't be a tribal disconnect between appreciation of certain types of vehicles. I get a lot of people incredibly angry about electric cars, saying that they'd rather be burnt in front of their family than drive around in an EV and all this stuff. And I'm like, they probably never even been in one.
Yeah.
Probably never even experienced one. It's like, it's so, and I said, it doesn't have to be so tribal. And that's why whenever I come out, you know, whenever I try and kind of defend it, I'll say, look, I've got a Dodge Charger. It's called a Charger and it's like the least EV car out there. Yeah. And I don't want to drive it every day. And having an EV appreciation doesn't mean that that car is going to be taken away from me.
Yeah.
It's just weird. It's this attitude that some people have. And I want to try and marry that together.
Yeah. But this is exactly it. I mean, I totally understand the frustrations with YouTube. We're, Andrew, really just getting started on YouTube, but sort of finding our way, trying to figure out what works. The scale of the opportunity is enormous. But yes, I totally understand the frustrations. However, it's a wonderful thing in many ways, Johnny, because it allows Johnny Smith to be Johnny Smith in, you know, in
it
his full sort of
incredible democratizing effect, doesn't it? Where anybody can have a go. And it may or it may not work. But, you know, I can remember I went and auditioned for a television show. I won't tell you which one it was. It's not one that you've been on. And I was told, I was 34 at the time, that I was too old.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was it. And that was my shot at it. I also think I would have been utterly awful if it had happened. And I wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes. But nevertheless, you know, anybody can just go and have a go, can't they?
Yeah.
And if you are very, very good and very, very dedicated and are knowledgeable and passionate about your subject, i.e. you can make it work.
Yeah, you can. And I think the world now allows all this self-publishing and allows you to have your voice heard on a totally different level to what it was when I left school or college.
Yeah.
And it is, like you say, it does allow people to be, it allows me to be me and do what I want to
and
do.
In the fullness of you as well. Yeah. You know, every aspect of you and the way that you appreciate cars. It's not like you are being pigeonholed and you have to only produce stuff about EVs when actually you love V8 muscle cars as well. And but you must really cherish that. I mean, when you're working on a magazine or working on a TV show, you are told what to report on, what stuff you're allowed to address, you know. But because you're the boss and it's YouTube, you get to choose.
Absolutely. And although I'm very thankful for the time I had on TV, I did feel like you were a puppet, really. You weren't in control of the finished product and stuff was edited down, so it was made very brief, and it used to frustrate me, all the detail being cut out of it and wasted, and that's when YouTube allows you to go, if you want to do a 45-minute episode on rebuilding a gearbox, you can. Mm-hmm. If you want to do a three-parter on that, you can. Mm-hmm. If you just want to talk about color codes for Ferraris, you can. And I think that's what's great about it. It's making niches not so niche. So and hopefully there's enough
an audience with the most niche stuff, can't you?
And I am thankful for it. Sometimes I don't have time to sit back and kind of dwell on it too much, but occasionally I do. It's usually if I've had a few glasses of wine or somebody really nice like you will go, you've done hundreds of videos now, and I go, have I? Oh yeah, I've done hundreds of videos, that's why I'm tired. Yeah. Okay.
So what's going to be the key to the Late Break Show for you going forward? Is it really just growing the channel, more views, so that you're a bit more protected from the vagaries of the algorithm and you have a bit more security?
I think so. I think, sadly, sponsorship is the way to guarantee success of a video and make sure that
sponsorship is fine as long as it's not making you say things you don't believe.
Yes.
And as long as it is helping you do your job, because it provides the funds for you to produce better quality videos, which therefore the people who follow what you do will enjoy more. I don't think there's any problem with that at all. And you know, there's nothing wrong with earning a living either. And as long as it's not conflicting you, bring it on.
Well, quite. And that's the thing. I know we're British and we've probably been a bit reticent to admit that, but that's the reality. So I think the best way to do it with YouTube is if you can get every episode sponsored before it's gone out the door, it pays for itself and then some. And then if it's successful through views, happy days, that's a double whammy. Yeah. But I do want to grow it like any business, but at the same time, it's got to maintain its authenticity. And for goodness sake, I want a garage. I'm fed up with not having a proper garage. I've got to build a proper garage.
And so
a real...
Ladies and gentlemen, please help Johnny get his garage. Go and subscribe to the Late Break Show on YouTube. And check him out.
Yeah, and then we all benefit.
Yeah.
Johnny.
Well, no, I consider you guys friends, so.
Oh, thank you.
And Richard too. Richard,
and likewise.
Richard.
Yes.
We have friendly bants, don't we, Andrew?
Oh, yes.
We do. Plenty. Plenty.
So, Johnny, we need to wrap it up there, but it's been wonderful to talk.
Thank you.
You have a unique perspective on the world of cars, and I think that's why people tune in.
Yeah.
You can't be pigeonholed, and that's
you're authentic. You're not, and I've no problem with people who just present because that's what they do because they're presenters. But you present, but more beyond that, you are a proper car enthusiast, and I think that ultimately that's what shines through. You have that, and we've talked about it on this podcast with other guests and between ourselves. You have the authenticity. You have the passion and you can't fake that. And I think ultimately that's what will sustain it.
Well, thank you.
Power to you. Seriously.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. I hope it stands the test of time. I do sometimes wake up and think, will people still want to watch me on video when I'm like an old guy?
Well, like
I don't know. But the thing is, I think, again, if it comes down to passion and enthusiasm and authority, I think authority on the subject without being preachy.
Knowing what you're talking about is, in our rather old-fashioned way, we think that's quite important.
Well, I agree, which is why I think the Intercooler is a credible platform, because its roots are in old school journalism, which means you question stuff.
Yeah.
You're not afraid to deliver facts, you deliver then opinion.
Yeah.
And people value it, which is why people buy cars off the back of things that you say. I've had people buy cars off the things I've said, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
Also quite nice.
Yeah.
And I guess people like Harry Metcalf, they do that as well. It's a strange, where media's gone from where I started 25 years ago is amazing. Would have never.
It's the independent, privately owned brands, which is what we all are, really. That's where the excitement is, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's cottage industries being able to, I guess, make decisions a little bit quicker and being a bit more.
But being more characterful and not having to concern themselves with, the agendas of their publishing companies, which may be very, very different to what the people who are actually involved want to be talking about. Mm. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's Johnny, true, we must leave it there. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Johnny. It's been fantastic to see you. We'll do it again. We'll get Porter on.
Yes, do get Porter on.
There is this sort of slightly nascent idea, isn't there, that there's going to be a sort of a T.I. Smith sniff and I don't know what you call it, a sort of super group. Podcast.
That would be great.
Which I think we should do. I think we should do. Maybe we should do it in front of an audience and have some fun. But until then, Johnny Smith, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to see you. And thanks again.
Boys, it's been a pleasure. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Johnny. And to everyone watching, everyone listening, thank you very much for doing so. Check out the Late Break Show on YouTube. Check out the Smith & Sniff podcast. Remember, please, to subscribe to the Intercooler podcast, whether you're listening on a podcast app or you're watching on YouTube, just hit that little subscribe or follow button. It helps enormously, and make sure you tune in again next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.